everyone, and welcome to Projector Room, the fortnightly podcast without Alan Gilday, but with Gareth Miles. Hello, Gareth.
And Ted Salmon.
He said he was going to come back at some point, didn't he? How long has he been away now? Can we call that in yet? It's March, the middle of March, and he left at the end of last year, didn't he? I reckon it's about time we nobbled him.
You know, I was talking about him the other day with another friend, and apparently he's keeping a really low profile, so I'm wondering if, has he done something? Or are we going to suddenly see him as the face of a new Marvel film, and it's Alan Gilday is Wankerman.
Either that, or he's in Nick somewhere. He's done something very, very naughty.
He responds to text messages, and you can't do that in prison without farting.
We're on show 206, and it's the middle of March, as I say, and just a couple of links for you. Projectorroom.co.uk is our website, and GarethMiles.com is where Gareth hangs, and TedSalmon.com is where I hang. So you can hang out with us there, or if you get fed up with that, you can go to MeWe, where we have lots of lovely listeners and readers and bleeders. No bleeders, just readers.
But I constantly forget about it, and I can't remember the last time I was in MeWe.
Oh dear. I've warned people of that. They leave you messages, and I say, he won't read it. They used to do that with Alan too. I said, Alan never comes here, he won't read it. So yes, everyone beware that the only person from the Projector Room crew that is in MeWe is me. So you can pass messages through me. Let's get to the news, shall we? And it's Oscar week. The Oscars were announced the other day, and every year we kind of think to ourselves, do we want to do this? Isn't it a load of crap, really? But then we still end up doing it, don't we? I reckon you ought to lead us through it.
I certainly could, yeah, because this year's Oscars were a wee bit different to last year's in that they had slightly different looking films. The landscape of the films that won is a little bit strange, because usually it's some sort of, you know, really highfalutin drama starring this person and this person and dealing with the struggles of the day. But instead, this year we had a clear couple of names that really just mopped up. And two of them were horror films, which is unthinkable. And one of them was a slightly comedic thriller that nails some points from a particular side of the spectrum in the American political landscape. And that got Leonardo DiCaprio his first... Oh, no, he didn't win, did he? Just thinking there. Did he win? No, he didn't win. I've actually seen it, to be honest. Ted, have you seen that?
No, I haven't. And Troy Dale tells us that it was so boring that he switched it off in the first 5 minutes. And other people have said that as well, but I haven't seen it, so I can't judge.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, it also won Paul Thomas Anderson Best Director Oscar. Got an adapted screenplay Oscar. Sean Penn got a supporting actor Oscar. I think that was the main one that I got. The other names of big films were Sinners, which was the one that was tipped to sort of basically clean the boards. But it got Michael B. Jordan got Best Leading Actor for that. And there was original screenplay and cinematography. So it picked up some of the lesser big gongs. Weapons did quite well with Amy, was it Madigan? Getting the Best Supporting Actress, and
which Chad Dixon was very happy about. He said she was pretty exceptional in Weapons. Warner Brothers are thinking about making a prequel film to that, starring her character, of course, Gladys Lilly.
Yeah, well, that would be a pretty good thing. I can't imagine that another volume in this series would. Other Oscar-y candidate, but, you know, stranger things have happened. There's two horror films there we're talking about. Hamlet, which isn't Hamlet, it's Hamnet. It got Jessie Buckley, her first leading actress, and I saw some funny posts of people going, oh, yeah, Jessie Buckley, no idea who she is, but I love her work. which is kind of funny. But obviously, Ted, you're the biggest, most exciting fan of Jessie Buckley, aren't you?
I am, and always have been. I think that she's just great, and we shall come to Hamnet later on in the main feature, because I have watched it, and I got some stuff to say about it. But yes, Jessie Buckley can do no wrong. She's not, you know, pin-up stuff like Ana de Armas for me, but she's just a fantastic actress, and I just love watching her. And I think my favourite role of hers was in Fargo, in the fourth series, I think it was, when she plays the nurse. She's just so funny.
Yeah.
So, yes.
Yeah, yeah, there's a few other films that have got the K-pop Demon Monsters, Demon Hunter, which is that animated manga-type film that I know my stepdaughter was big into, but I couldn't tell you anything about it. Avatar managed to get visual effects, and F1 got sound, and there's a few other ones that they handed out. But, you know, I think that this year was quite refreshingly different to previous years, and I don't think too many people are really grumbling about it, with the possible exception of some people who just do not like the content of one battle after another. But, you know, it's just...
I just remembered that my sister emailed me this morning, and she said, I watched one battle after another and I thought it was crap. So it's obviously divided opinion, and everyone in Hollywood thinks it's absolutely fantastic, and most other people think it's bollocks.
and obviously you're a bit surprised that the latest outing of Winnie the Pooh didn't manage to get on there.
What is interesting, though, is there are some, if you dig down to the kind of bottom end of the announcements, the ones that are kind of done last, there's some films there that just beg one to track down and watch, like the live action short film The Singers, and Two People Exchanging Saliva, and The Girl Who Cried Pearls, and then there's a documentary short called All the Empty Rooms. I've never heard of any of these, and so, you know, it's quite a good idea to kind of, you know, ignore the top end and dig down a bit and then see what's down there and check it out, I think, as well.
It must be really difficult to do the live action short film, because there's billions of them every year.
Yeah.
From all corners of the earth, any sort of emerging film country will be doing, like Northern Ireland has, what was it, 10 shorts or something like that they put out every year, and then there's a bunch of shorts in between. And, you know, if Northern Ireland's doing that, then there's got to be a load of other countries that have similar programs. So being able to whittle it down to like a top 5 or top 10, I think it is now, it must be really hard work.
Yeah. But, yeah, as you say, kind of interesting. Did you mention Frankenstein? You didn't, did you?
No.
Because that won 3 things. And I thought that was okay. As I reported on the show here, at the time I saw it, I kind of kept thinking of the Kenneth Branagh one and thinking this was not so good. And I keep meaning to go back and watch it again. But, yeah, this won 3 awards, so might be worth a look. A second look for me. And if you haven't watched it already, it'd be interesting to see what one thinks. So,
but you know, there are some of the lesser ones as well, like makeup and hairstyles is one, costume designs is another, and then production design is another. So, I don't think you don't tend to see a promotion for a film going from the production designer of Heat, from the makeup artist of Howard the Duck.
I suppose not.
Yeah.
There you go. Anyway, that was the Oscars 2026, and Hey, we shall live to see another day. The only other bit of news I stumbled into was a Guardian thing about film distribution in the wake of kind of DVD and Blu-ray. I know you're still into the physical media, but they were suggesting that there's this guy this guy that set up this company called Video Storage, and he's proposing distributing media on USB drives instead of discs, DVDs, Blu-rays, anything that's gone before, or streaming or whatever, but actually giving, you know, selling people stuff on drives which they can plug into what they want. It wasn't terribly clear about how they were going to secure it though. And it was talking about them bundling things. So you buy a drive and it's got like five things on it every month or something. Did you have a look at this article?
I did, yeah. It sounds something along the lines of basically Netflix, you know, whenever it was originally a disc rental company, mm-hmm. and you could pick from their catalogue, and these kind of credit card-y type things with USB at the end, they allow you to fill it up with various different bits and pieces. I suppose maybe, you know, they could sell you a subscription that allows you at any one time 50 movies or two TV series or something like that, and then they can just fill these up. But I don't see this as being, whilst it's called storage, it doesn't seem to be like they're looking for this to be the next evolution in film distribution storage. You know, this isn't to replace people's DVD collection or 4K collection. It is more of a way to get the films to people who don't want to have to rely on streaming. And if the size is right, then they could potentially send you really good copies of films that have very high bit rates and stuff on them. What do you play it back on? Do they have to copy it on? So if you were to say, I want all of The Sopranos in 1080p or even 4K, can they do that? Is it going to have to sit there and copy for an hour before it eventually gets sent out to you? And then do you have to plug it into your PlayStation? I noticed that it's USB Type-C, for which most TVs or smart connections don't accept.
Well, you can get an adapter, can't you? But I got the impression that they were dictating to you what was going to be on it. Certainly at first, they were, you know, they're saying, look, here's the bundle. This month we're going to put this bunch of stuff on it, and if you want to subscribe, we'll send one to you. What I don't quite understand though is how they're going to secure it. So, or are they just going to let you then do what you like with it? Because inevitably, if you've got a film on a USB stick, you're then just free to send it round to everyone in the world you know. Unless they do a Mission Impossible and have self-exploding files that only last so long or something.
that people would pay for that. Well, having a quick skim through it, I see that customers can subscribe for a quarterly collection, which is five features and five short films, or buy individual films and custom combinations as a digital indie movie mixtape.
Oh, okay.
So mixtape is an interesting way of, you know, illustrating it so that people can maybe get the idea. Mm-hmm. But no, I don't think this, even the look of it, you know, it doesn't scream at you, ooh, yeah, you know, I want this. Right. It's something that we're going to be talking on the next Tech Addicts. I have a wee... I want to have a chin wag about it, and it kind of relates to what we're going to be talking about later in the show as well. But it doesn't scratch the itch that physical media collectors love, mm-hmm. where you get artwork and you've got something that sits on your shelf and you're proud of.
Mm-hmm. Like LPs for me.
Yes, exactly that.
Okay. Right, let's move on. Suggested viewing and reviews from our lovely listeners. And we decided to do something else a little bit different this time. Instead of kind of reading out long reviews and getting our words all wrong and mispronouncing people's names and being in trouble, we thought we'd go for a kind of quick-fire one and then point you to people's reviews in our lovely MeWe group. If you click on any of these links in the show notes, it will take you to MeWe, beware. And if you are not a member of MeWe, you have to join before you can get to it. It's just an experiment. We'll see how it goes. But quick fire, you can start.
Oh, may I? Okay. Yeah. Well, Chad Dixon has written in on War Machine, which is on Netflix. He's given a full review, as Ted did explain. Unoriginal story, aping the whole Predator thing. He didn't really mind this being an unoriginal story, aping Predator. But as it looks good and was well acted satisfactorily, and was acted satisfactorily, and is just about the right length, but it won't be everyone's cup of tea.
No.
Thanks, Chad. It does look good, that, actually. And I have heard some really good reports about it, where it's doing what the Terminator should be doing in the way of being better.
Fair enough. Robert McCrown is next. He's been watching Young Sherlock, which is a 2026 TV thingy-bob on Amazon Prime Video. The Guy Ritchie one, he says, on the telly. Unusual, he says. Plenty of twists and turns. A good romp, even though easy to predict. He enjoyed more than he thought he would do at the outset. So that's on Amazon Prime Video, if anyone fancies it.
Adrian Brain has written in on The Capture, which is a TV series that ran from 2019 to 2022. It is about deep fake videos, constant video surveillance, crumbling judicial system. He says it's an excellent police procedural, murder mystery, and it's gripping, binge-worthy. Seasons 1, 2, and 3 are on the BBC iPlayer, and click on to read more if you want to see more, hear more, or absorb more.
Okay, and we round it up with Chad again, and he's talking about Project Hail Mary, which I think we had in our coming soon at some point. He rates it the best hard science fiction film he's seen since Interstellar in 2014. Ryan Gosling performs well, and Sandra Hüller has a good supporting role. Again, we'll link to his full written review in the show notes there. Sandra Hüller, if that's how you pronounce it, she's the German lady who was in that film that I watched where her husband fell out of the window, and it won loads of awards and stuff, and I can't remember the name of it now, but I really enjoyed that. I thought it was really good, and she's a really good actress.
Her husband fell out of the window?
Well, the character, not her real husband. Her husband, the character's husband, fell out the window at the top of the house and, you know, dead on the ground. And she was being accused of having murdered him or pushing him out. And she had to defend herself. And it ends up being a courtroom drama. But anyway, we digress. Project Hail Mary is what Chad was watching. And if you're into sci-fi, then and Ryan Gosling, and if you liked Interstellar, then you might want to give that a go. So thanks, Chad, Adrian, Robert, and we'll move on. Fandom Focus, it was your turn to take the lead this time. So what have you chosen for Fandom Focus?
Well, I realised the other day, whenever I was picking up my gaming console, I have a Retroid Pocket that I do quite like playing old classic games on. And I realized just the sheer volume of them, that they're actually video game tie-ins to movies. And I tend to favor those, even though they're generally considered to be poor. More times than not, a video game tie-in from a movie is poor compared to other titles on a system. But it made me think about, you know, the approach that they've taken and things that they do. For video game tie-ins, I had a quick look around because I thought, what was the very first video game tie-in? And there's kind of two answers to this. The first one is the first official movie license was Atari's Raiders of the Lost Ark, that confusing jumble of a game that no idea what's going on. I've played it a couple of times and haven't a clue. You can watch people on YouTube play it and they'll explain to you what they're doing. It seems a lot harder to actually comprehend what's going on than it does a modern day game. It beat E.T. To its release back in 1982. And E.T. was the game that famously caused the video game crash. So, yeah, it was terrible. Reading a wee bit further, Atari's Superman from 1978 was actually the first video game that was tied into a movie license. So it wasn't an official movie license. It was let's do a game, based on that. And they took an old game called Adventure, and they retooled part of it and turned it into Superman, and it became quite popular. There was also a game which I think was in the arcades called Death Race, and they say that it was inspired by the game Death Race 2000 from 75. Uh-huh. But it wasn't, official that way. But I suppose you could say like Space Invaders would be inspired by classic sci-fis of 1950s and 60s and that sort of thing. So, but I thought that was kind of interesting. But it made me think about the whole landscape of video game tie-ins and the good ones and bad ones and interesting ones that have happened over the years and how they try to replicate the movie to the small screen, even from the point of view that there was games like, was it one of the Terminator games that they weren't allowed to act? I think it was Terminator 2. The game developers weren't allowed to see the film in case they dropped any plot lines or anything like that, or spoiled anything for the larger audience. So they had to try to just make up a game based around the idea of what was happening in the movie without seeing any of it. It just goes to show, that's the level of care they had for the movie tie-in. They knew it would make a couple of million, so just crap out anything and we'll slap the name of Terminator, Aliens, or whatever onto it and just sell it. And whenever they get home, it'll be too late for them to do anything about it, we suppose. There's games of Indiana Jones, and Star Wars has millions of games. If you have actually go and have a look on Mobi Games at the amount of Star Wars games there are, you just realize how popular movie tie-ins are, and some of them are just your really ropey tie-ins at that. Some of the ones that I've really enjoyed over the years were, Star Trek had some really good ones. There was Star Trek the 25th anniversary. It was a graphic adventure. And then you had Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, the graphic adventure as well. And those were ones that really captured me when I was a kid. And I loved playing through them. Because they kind of followed the plot line of the film, or in Star Trek's case, it was an entirely new plot line, but there was voices done by the original cast. So it was really sort of interactive Star Trek and interactive Indiana Jones. And then GoldenEye as well, which is a video game that always needs talked about whenever it comes to movie tie-ins, because there was about a year where I spent playing with my friends on the Nintendo 64. GoldenEye, we would just run around shooting each other, and it was so much fun on split screen on the one TV, all of us just sitting together, having a beer, laughing, mitching off college and university and that, and just sitting there playing this, smoking cigarettes and thinking, this is life, this game is amazing. What about you? Have you any sort of related games that you have played that you knew? Maybe you went to them because you liked the movie so much.
The trouble is that I'm not, as you well know, I'm just not a gamer, and I hardly ever have been. I had my spell with the SNES, mm-hmm. where I was playing Mario. What was it called? Super Mario World, and I was glued to that. And then we had a go at Street Fighter as well, but I seem to remember Street Fighter, the film, was really crappy and bad. But I did go on a bit of a hunt after I saw you put this up for discussion, and I was surprised at some of the things. Just firstly to mention The Last of Us. Now, I've never played The Last of Us as a game, but as you know, I completely was bowled over by the TV show, so I can't talk about the game. But if that's if it's anything like that, then I'll be all over that. But I also stumbled into a couple of other things, like The Thing, for example. Now, I loved The Thing, the film, and if the game is anything like that, then that might be quite fun, I guess. But the most interesting one for me, I think, is probably The Warriors. And I can see, knowing The Warriors from 1979 really well, the film, I can just see how that could be made into a game with this, you know, this gang being hunted across across New York by another gang in the dead of night, and all sorts of people popping up, and I can imagine how The Warriors as a game might work. But yeah, you're right, there is a lot out there, but I just haven't ever tracked any of this down because I'm not a gamer, so it's down to you. Have you played The Warriors?
No, I haven't. I remember it being released, I've never really been a big fan of the film, so I didn't check it out, I have to say. But I watched The Warriors when I was really young, too young, in fact, and I've never watched it since. So it is something that I should really revisit and have a go with.
Right.
The Last of Us is the perfect example of how things are. I think they're improving. I would dare to say that over the last couple of years, we've had a few games based on films that are really good. There was a couple of good Terminator games that were released over the last couple of years, and RoboCop as well. And they do capture the energy of the film finally after all these years. And even Teenage Mutant Ninja or Hero Turtles, depending on where you live, there was a few great games along those, along with those films. And it just, you know, going back and looking at them, there was the odd time that you did get a better game than the film. Mm-hmm. I remember there was a Batman Forever I had on the Mega Drive, and I much preferred the game over the film. And then there was the Chronicles of Riddick, although to be fair, the Chronicles of Riddick, Escape from Butcher Bay, I think it was called, it wasn't actually based on the film, but it was based on the universe created by the films starring Vin Diesel. And they were games that it was a game that was just really good, and I really wanted to see it as a film because the game was so good. Same with Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis. That would have been a fantastic movie had they made it. And there's driving games and all sorts of things that I've collected over the years, and it's really nice to think back to them and how much better they were than some of the films. I just find it a really interesting thing. And I think if you're an avid lover of a particular film, you owe it to yourself to go out and get a few things to go along with the film. I think if you have a favorite movie, you should have the film on disc. You should have a book, a novel or a tie-in if they've done one of those. You should have the soundtrack. And if possible, if there is one, you should have the game, no matter how bad it is, and put them together into a nice little bundle. And, you know, that's the film. You know, get these things, and you've got everything there.
Spoken Jurassic like a true Park. Collector.
Well, Jurassic Park's another one, a bit like Star Wars. Just they crapped out all sorts of games, and it was any excuse to get another game going. Mm. You know, there's a couple of different games based around the first film. That did the same thing over and over again. I think it was Jurassic Park Rampage Edition was pretty much identical to Jurassic Park, the game, but they just pepped it up a bit and added in a few more levels or a bit of blood or something like that, and released it as a whole new product, and just to rip the kids off.
I can see that. I can see that. Well, some things working though. Like I said, Death Race 2000. I loved that film. You know, and I can see that working as you drive a car around and get points for driving over pensioners. And you know, you could just see how that would work. The same as The Warriors. I could see how that would work. But The Thing, I can't see in a game of The Thing, you know, how that could work. It's not really, I don't think that that would, I mean, not that I've ever played it, but I know the film really well, and I can't see what they could do with it that wouldn't be just a bit pedestrian, really.
Yeah, well, it got remade recently as well, The Thing. I think the Night Divers went and made The Thing remastered because it is so fondly thought of. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it's actually based on the films. I think, I haven't played it myself, I think it's based, you know, in that universe and took place at a camp nearby or in between or after the events of the original film. So it hasn't got MacReady running around having fun. But yeah, it looks quite good. Maybe I should give that a go at some stage. Yeah. Mm. You too.
Right. Okay then. Well, thanks.
And then that. Lego as well. Lego is actually one that's really got stuck into it, where they've done Star Wars and Harry Potter and all that. And that, you know, the level of detail they go to by using the original soundtracks and even getting some of the original voices and things, it kind of blurs the line between what's an official tie-in and what's not. And everybody seems to be game for Lego games. And I quite like that as well. It allows them to lampoon it in such a way as well. It's worth mentioning and worth checking out. If you love Star Wars, you should maybe give the Lego games a go as well. My son was very much into them, and I enjoyed playing the Indiana Jones ones to a certain extent. I got sick to death of them after a while, but they were quite enjoyable initially.
Okay, then.
There you go.
Very nice. So that's your fandom focus, video game tie-ins. So thanks for that. We'll be back with another one of those on the next show. For now, it's Flop of the Fortnite
actually,
time.
Actually, before we do, I do notice that you put in the show notes Street Fighter from 1994,
which I think is actually,
it's quite a fun one, that, because, you know, Street Fighter is a film that's based off of the video game.
Yeah.
But then Street Fighter, the film, got its own video game tie-in as well.
I played the Street Fighter on the SNES, as you call it.
That's Street Fighter 2.
Yeah. Street Fighter 2. Oh, okay, so that's not the same. I thought the film I'd seen was the one with Kylie Minogue in it. Is that right?
Yeah. No, right, they made Street Fighter based off of Street Fighter 2.
Right.
And then they made a game of Street Fighter, the movie, with digitized characters from the movie. So it was a game based on a movie based on a game.
Right, okay. Very confusing.
Sorry, carry on. Flop of the Fortnite.
Yeah, no. Street Fighter 2, we did quite enjoy playing that. It was quite good fun. But yeah, Flop of the Fortnite. I'm going to throw Train Dreams in there, which might be unfair because I only watched half of it. But I did throw it out to the group to say to them, did anyone actually make it through to the end of this? Because it's just so boring and slow and dull. It's like watching paint dry. I did get halfway through, but it comes across as a really dull episode of Little House on the Prairie, you know, and it's set in that kind of same time with the same houses and the family and the clothing and just everything. It's all, but nothing happens. It's really, really boring. So I said to the group, what's going on? Chad chipped in and said, yes, the pace is basically the same until the end. It has a good environmental message, but I do agree, it's very downbeat. I thought William H. Macy had a great little cameo, and I didn't actually get to see William H. Macy. I guess that must have been in the second half of it. And if it's a cameo, then it probably wasn't very long anyway. So that's for me. I think it was just dull, boring. And I tested that with my sister as well, and she said, yeah, she gave up on it. Very, very dour. Have you seen it?
I watched the trailer, and that was enough. I had discussions with my wife about putting it on one night, but ultimately I was really hoping that she would not go for it, and she didn't go for it, and that pleased me.
Really, really boring. I'll tell you something that won't please you is me putting Friday the 13th, the 1980 film, into Flop of the Fortnite. And I'm going to be putting this.
Fighting talk.
I'm going to be putting this in because I went to see this film at the cinema in the 80s, in the early 80s, and I can remember being thrilled and chilled by it, especially the finale when, spoiler alert if you like, when, you know, there's a jump moment at the end of the film, and the whole cinema leapt out of their seats when this happened, including me, and it was really impactful, and it was just great. And my memory of going to the cinema 45 years ago to watch this film was just so different to watching it now. And it comes across now as a low budget. Performances are wooden and terrible. It comes across like a 1980s TV show, really. There's no scariness in it. It's not frightening in any way at all. There are a couple of gory scenes which are quite interestingly done, but it's very obvious that they're, you know, special effects of the day, and they're dummies, and it's just not really happening. The script is really bad. The characters are just all making really stupid, dumb decisions, you know, walking into dark rooms and walking towards strange noises and isolating themselves at the wrong moment and this sort of thing. And it just was dumb. Kevin Bacon could have saved it, except the young Kevin Bacon was just horribly underused. And in actual fact, when he copped it, well, his death was probably the best one in the lot. That seemed to be the most realistic to me. But all of the cast just seemed largely uninterested, perhaps except for the lead girl, the Princess Di lookalike, Alice. She was played by Adrienne King. She looked as though she was interested in being in it and doing it, but most of the other ones didn't. When Jason's mum popped up, played by Betsy Palmer, she looked as though she was quite interested as well, and it's worth seeing her demise as well. So she was kind of talking to herself a lot towards the end of it, and she came across as a real maniac. So anyway, all I'm saying is that this, I've seen this now 45 years apart, and I think that the 2026 audience will just think it's funny and stupid, and they'll take the piss out of it, whereas my memory of it in watching it at the cinema was so different. So I'm sorry, but in 1980, I won't put it in Flop of the Fortnight. In 2026, I will.
Right, okay. Well, you're entitled to your opinion, even if it's wrong and stupid.
Defend it.
No, I think Friday the 13th is very much a product of its time. It's really simple. It's cheap. They put it into the theatres, and it gave people what exactly they wanted to see at the time. It's tame by today's standards, but it's still just a beautiful lens of the time that it was released, when things were simpler. It's a really simple horror film. There's no twists and turns like they like to throw into the Scream movies and the new Halloween series, and it is just what you want to sit down and see. There's a killer, people are killed, it's a wee bit sexy, and you know, it's got style aplenty. You know, there's the sound, the kill, 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 die, die, die. that's synonymous with that landscape.
I just thought that was funny, though. When that was going on, it just was comic to me, not stylish. I think we're going back again to what we've said many times before, is that the difference in our ages. You know, you grew up at a time when you could look back and still appreciate these things, and I look back and laugh.
Yeah, well, but you very much enjoyed it whenever you first saw it.
Yeah, yeah.
There was nothing quite like it out there at the time.
Sure.
And it spent its time. I remember really well the bit with as a Marcy Stanler, where she is in the bathroom, And there's something, there's noises happening. And I think she's in her pants. To be honest, that's probably why it sticks out in my memory. But it's a really tense, elongated sequence that's just the right length of time. They don't spend too long on it, but they spend long enough to make it exciting. And it just worked. And I can imagine the whole audience seeing that for the first time, going, "Oh!"
And then she walks into this. The character's just made stupid decisions, because at the end of that scene in the bathroom, she then hears a noise and walks into the darkness, doesn't even put the light on, and sets herself up for whatever's in there.
Yes, because they're young kids, they're inexperienced, and they just think it's probably one of their friends having a laugh.
Yeah.
And they've got no reason to be scared. And okay. that's an interesting thing about it, is that, you know, it is the psychology of the college student or the kid who is you're invulnerable at that time. I was talking the other day about how I don't like going up ladders anymore, because I'm worried if I fall and break my leg, that's me off work for a while and not be able to pay the mortgage and things. Whereas that age, you know, you would go and investigate the dark without thinking too much about it, because you're naive and silly. Yeah. But I know that at that time there was a whole load of other films that came out inspired by this, because it was a really cheap way of making an effective horror film or making an effective bank account from a horror film. And they just sort of crapped things out left, right, and centre. And some were good and most were pretty bad. But along the ways, they managed to have a few winners. And I think Friday the 13th is a winner. And Sean S. Cunningham did really well with it. And the following franchises... is it just shows that they?
I think it was. I think it was a winner. That's the point I'm making. Really, is watching it now? It's just a joke, but I totally agree with you. It was a winner. And when I first saw it, as you said, at the cinema, it was great. I really enjoyed it. But now, there's nothing there at all. It's just. It's funny. It's a farce. It's a joke. Anyway, you know. Perhaps I'm not as open to you as things aging, and you can jump back into when you first saw them and enjoy it with the same frame of mind, and I'm approaching it with today's frame of mind. Don't know.
Yeah, probably. And then I suppose I like distinguishing them as well, because I've seen all of them a good number of times, but you know, my memory gets a bit fuzzy, and I can't remember which is which. And you know, I was thinking, is this is the one with the guy in the wheelchair? No, that's the second one. Or is that the third one? And so, you know, I need to watch them all through again. And I go back through going, oh, yes, I remember that.
Yeah. Anyway, there you go. I'm putting it in. I don't care what you say. And we're done. Private screening is next.
Dreadful.
And I chose last time in private screening for us to have a look at the TV series that we had in Coming Soon, which we both kind of thought looked maybe okay, called Scarpetta, which is a 8-part series on Amazon Prime Video, which was released all 8 parts last week. I watched 2 of them in the end, and it's a show about Nicole Kidman, who plays this pathologist in the kind of Quincy ME type way, if anyone remembers that. Jamie Lee Curtis is in there, Bobby Cannavale, and Simon Baker. So a pathologist uses forensic technology to solve crimes. Very basic, and on the face of it, maybe quite simple. I watched the first one, and I made some notes after that, and it looked grisly and dark, and as I've noted here, a bloody version of Quincy ME, and I thought, yeah, maybe this is all right. But then it started to move into the back-end drama of her life, the Nicole Kidman character, who's the pathologist, and then it skipped back to in time to 1998. So we're leaping between 2026 and 1998, And at first, I thought that they used Nicole Kidman in both ends of that and made her up pretty well. But I checked that, and it's not. But she does quite. She does the actress in the 1998 one does actually look quite a lot like her. Anyway, because it starts to kind of creep into the back end drama of her life and relationships and family stuff, it just became a complete yawn fest. Then it started shuffling towards political stuff, and I thought, oh no, American politics, here we go. So I don't know. I think Nicole Kidman was all right. I think they could have chosen someone else, honestly, in the role to make it better. She didn't really come across as being that interested. Bobby Cannavale was very good, and his younger version was too. This younger version thing, I spoke about this before, about in relation to the Dexter show, where they'd really cleverly picked out some younger actors to ape the older ones. And they did it so well. It was done really, really well. And I think that the kind of idiosyncrasies and quirks of the older versions here, they did that quite well as well. You know, the young Bobby Cannavale copy had got the look about him very much, and his facial movements as well. But the thing that completely ruined it for me, absolutely ruined it, was Jamie Lee Curtis. Her character was really, really annoying. She was just loud-mouthed and gobby and arguing with Nicole Kidman's character at every opportunity. She was just in your face all the time and loud, and she just ruined the whole show for me, and it would have been so much better without her. I did see in the credits that she was one of the executive producers, so I don't know whether that meant she could, you know, write her own part and make sure she was in it or not, but having dug deeper, other commentators are saying they agree with me. I had a look on Reddit, and lots of people on Reddit were saying the same thing. They also said that she played exactly the same character in some show called The Bear, which I haven't seen, and also in Knives Out. I seem to remember her playing the same role pretty much in Knives Out. I just thought she was ruining it, and so after the second episode, which I got to and completed, I was going to go on to the third one, but I just couldn't bring myself to do it. And I was done after that. And I decided that I was going to give it four, because some of the autopsy scenes and the kind of bodies and stuff, when she was cutting people up, that the special effects were done quite well on the slab. And I thought that was those scenes were quite good. And that's where it should have been focusing, not on her home life and not with Jamie Lee Curtis shouting at her and ruining the whole thing. So those are my views. I'm giving it 4 out of 15, and now over to you.
Well, I've only watched one episode of it. I didn't realise there was a second episode yet. I struggled to get through that first episode, but I did see the potential for, you know, a fairly interesting timeline split autopsy procedural type thing, but the whole domestic drama side of it that came in, and they spent far too long shouting at each other toward the end of the episode, the first episode, and it really, really irked me as well. I had trouble getting through that, and you know, I think it's bold of Jamie Lee Curtis to play such an ugly character. And obviously she's relishing it and enjoying it, but it's a real caveat for the episode. And to be honest, what I was hoping for, I didn't quite get. I was really hoping for that kind of interesting procedural thing, and there was little elements of it. And she walks in, and you can see. Well, there is the younger version of Nicole Kidman, who I don't think looks like her at all. she walks in and she's noting things, and you're like, oh, right, she's going to bring this all together in Columbo's kind of way, and by the end of it, we'll have a nice resolution. But it's an overarching storyline that's going to build up over a number of weeks. And I thought, oh, no, I just actually quite like to sit down and watch something a bit lighter than this. Maybe it's just the mood that I was sitting watching it in. Mm-hmm. But I wanted it to be lighter. I wanted to see Nicole Kidman and Jamie Lee Curtis actually having an interesting time on screen together, not yeah. shouting at each other.
Yeah.
It's like, well, we've got this opportunity of having two great actresses. It would be nice to see them have some chemistry. Mm-hmm. And this is not the chemistry that I'm looking for. And Bobby Cannavale, I think he's one of the best actors out at the moment. I really enjoy him. And he wasn't in the first episode very much, as Simon Baker wasn't in it either. And I think, obviously, maybe they appear a bit more in the second episode.
Bobby Cannavale's character gets engaged by Nicole Kidman as the kind of psychic to help her. So he's in it a lot in the second one.
But what they did do at the end of the first episode was they put a trailer on for the rest of the season, you know, with quick shots of what happened, you know, Cannavale punching someone and her shouting about this and doing that and looking shocked and plot twist lines and things to try and draw people in to come back. And it actually put me off.
Right.
And I thought, no, there's more of this to go. I appreciate the dark and gloomy atmosphere that they painted, the fog around the side of the lake and things like that. That all looked really well, and I thought, oh, it's nice to have a really sort of dark looking TV series rather than everything being so bright and clean. They seem to have really, you know, focused in on artistic style here. But then after all that was done, they ended up in the house shouting at each other, and I thought, no.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah, totally. When they were doing the autopsy stuff and the body stuff and the naked dead women around the lake, you're right, that was really good and engaging. And they just, that should have been what it was about, not them bickering.
So I think it's one of those TV shows that you let someone else watch and then come back to you and say, oh no, it gets really good. You know, I did that with Breaking Bad, which started out with fairly strong reviews, but I thought, no, I'll let other people do it. And I'll let season two and season three, and then it's got to fall off. But eventually, you know, people start moving toward it and it gets better and better as it goes along. Mm-hmm. That's what this could be. And I'll wait until someone tells me, oh no, this is absolutely cracking. The first and second episodes weren't great. It got better as it went along.
Okay.
So I'll happily sit back and let someone tell me.
Well, what I do know is that Jamie Lee Curtis' character doesn't get any better. She, throughout the whole eight episodes, which incidentally are all available, they were all made available on day one on Amazon Prime Video. Jamie Lee Curtis' character just carries on doing that right the way through. So that's why I gave up after two, really. If there was any prospect of her stopping doing that and it changing, I probably would have carried on, but I just couldn't do it, which is a shame. Anyway, what are you going to score it?
I think I'll go with six, so that's a total of 10. If I add things, 1, 2, 3, carry the 4, 10. Yeah, okay.
And that puts it quite near the bottom. In fact, it's the only one we've ever scored 10 for, which is sitting between
one less than Tech War. Right.
Yeah, Tech War. Black Knight and Truth Seekers and Locked In. Yeah, there's nothing else of note round there, really. It's the dead end. But I'm with you. If someone comes back and says, oh, no, you get back to it, it gets better, then I might. But at the moment, I don't have the motivation to do that. So that's it for this private screening. What are you going to set down for homework for us for the next one?
Well, I thought I'd keep it in the family. And, you know, I said I like Bobby Cannavale, so he and his hair are in Trap House, which stars Dave Bautista, Jack Champion, Sophie Lillis, and Tony Dalton, who you like. From,
do I?
Yeah, Better Call Saul. He's Lalo.
Oh, right, Lalo. Okay.
So I figured that would be good. A round, good old-fashioned action crime movie.
Okay. Yeah, that looks all right.
That's on Amazon Prime.
Cool. Okay, Trap House it is. And we will come back to the next show and talk about that one. Right, let's go for theme treats now. And it's the 2026 Pick a Theme. It was your turn last time. And I said to you, don't choose American sports. But what did you do?
Well, it's going to be impossible to do this without choosing sports. Sports movies are such a big thing, and there are so many of them. And I was even thinking that it might be a good choice for a full year, and each show we could do a different sport. That would be great. But I picked basketball because there's a couple of absolutely brilliant basketball movies out there. And I'll just open because I'm quite enthusiastic about sports movies because they're generally feel-good movies. There are some that aren't, but I'll throw in a few honourable mentions to start with because people will instantly think of one and go, ah, that's the best basketball movie ever made. And that is, of course, White Men Can't Jump. Yeah, I'm not going to go on about that one because it's so well-known. Blue Chips is another one, good one, with Nick Nolte. And Celtic Pride. I quite like, with Damon Wayans and Dan Aykroyd and someone else, Daniel Stern. That's somewhat of an underrated comedy. It's worth checking that out. But the main one I wanted to talk about, and I've seen it a few times in my life, and it always makes me feel good, it's Hoosiers, with Gene Hackman and Dennis Hopper. And it's got a beautiful score by Jerry Goldsmith. And there's a little bit of a love relationship with Barbara Hershey as well, between Gene Hackman and Barbara Hershey. And this is just a sports movie that hits it out of the park. Everything about this, it just draws you further and further in. And it'll make you well up and cry at certain stages. Dennis Hopper's character is maddeningly frustrating, and Gene Hackman is not the lovely doofus that you're expecting. He's a wee bit more of a hard edge, but not quite as hard edge as Gene Hackman does play in other movies. You know, he's just in between those two, and it's a really good place for him to be with this movie. And they obviously go and he takes a somewhat underperforming basketball team, high school team, and takes them all the way to the majors or whatever it is. And they've lost their star player because I've forgotten what it was. It's been a while since I watched this. I watched this on TN a wee while ago when I was flying out to the States, and someone tapped me and went, I love that movie. Yeah, it's right, man. I think he loses his father or something like that, and he goes into something of a catatonic state and doesn't want to play basketball anymore. But he sees the team start to perform well, and it's a question of just Gene Hackman's ability to be able to bring the team together, being a complete outsider from this small town in America, and he comes in and defies the odds and takes it forward. And I know that's a very cliche story, but this one just nails it perfectly. Everything about it is absolutely superb. It's got a little bit of wit, it's got a little bit of love, it's got a little bit of drama here and there. It gets everything in the right commodity, the right measure. Yeah, we'll go with that. The right measure. And the payoff is well deserved by the time you get to the end of it. I love Hoosiers. Have you seen it or heard of it?
No, and I would not be drawn to want to watch it, frankly. But I have to say that the cast looks really good. And I do like Barbara Hershey, who played in one of Woody Allen's films, Hannah and Her Sisters, and she was the girl that was being chased by the Michael Caine character. And so I do know who she is, and I obviously know who the other two male leads are. So
Hackman and Hopper.
I've lost my notes now. It's so frustrating. I really, really like Dennis Hopper. I think he's great in anything I've seen him in. I find him a super actor, and he's just great fun as well. Gene Hackman we've done on the show before loads of times. But it's just this whole basketball thing. There's no way that I would watch this, even though that had that cast on it, unless someone totally convinced me that it was worth watching, because it would just annoy me, this whole American sport thing. But anyway, do carry on.
Fair enough. Well, I wanted to put in an underperformer, one that not many people have gone to, but it's worth looking at if you want to watch a really decent basketball movie. And it went direct to video here in the UK. I don't know how it managed over in the States. I don't think it did particularly well, but it's a well-rounded basketball movie called The Air Up There, and it stars Kevin Bacon, and it's about a basketball coach who heads out to Africa to recruit a very lanky basketball star that he, it's his last chance to deliver a big splash star in the American basketball scene. And he heads out there, and he has to, there's a bit of culture clash comedy on both sides of the Atlantic, and it's just a good film. It's a solid all-rounder. I caught it on Sky one day because I do like Kevin Bacon, and I thought, I'll give this a go, and blimey, I got into it. I really did, and Kevin Bacon's quite short, and seeing him playing basketball alongside the team with his dodgy knee, it made for quite an interesting entertainment. But by the time they got it to the big climactic basketball game, I was totally invested in it, and I really enjoyed it. And I think that if you're looking for a decent basketball game or basketball movie to watch, and you've seen all of the biggies, then this is one to...
I'd much rather watch this one. I'm watching the trailer roll, and it looks much more interesting than the first one, Hoosiers. You know, based in Africa, and there's lots of action going on, and helicopters crashing, and, you know, a lot of it is away from the basketball, which, you know, great. If it's turned into an action film, it looks really good. And it's been directed by Starsky.
Yeah, that's right, yes. Paul Glaser.
Paul Michael Glaser, and he, I can't remember if I knew that he was a director of films, but he's just Starsky to me.
Yeah, he went on to do a few. He did one really big one, and I remember watching some of the special features on the 4K. It's not Total Recall. I think it was an Arnie film.
He's done 21, apparently. So he's directed 21... Oh, that includes TV shows. 21 credits.
No, but he did do a really big movie, and I'm just running down to say, The Cutting Edge, there's an ice skating movie, if you want to watch. The Running Man. That was his big movie. And right. He did The Air Up There fairly soon after that.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, if I was going to watch a basketball film, that one looks much more attractive to me, I have to say.
So you prefer your basketball movies to have
no basketball, yeah, and not in America. Oh dear.
All right, well, what this should be interesting then. What, Ted, tell us about some of the basketball movies you like.
I haven't seen any basketball films, and I was going to have to try and hunt one down in order to take part in this conversation. And I tried to find something that was just, you know, related, but not just American basketball all over it. And there was a film that you, I remember you put me onto ages ago. You thought I might like it, called Lilia Forever. From 2002. So I did watch it in the end. I think it just takes it away from the kind of flurry of American comedies, to be honest. And the film is about a girl in, where is she? In Russia, who falls in love with this guy. And he basically dupes her into moving to Sweden with her. And when she gets to Sweden, she gets taken into, you know, human trafficking and used as a prostitute, which she knew nothing about before she went, etc., etc. And it's about her life. It's a true story, incidentally. And in my review, which I'll link to, I've put the links to the wiki page about the real girl that this is based around. And so it's in that respect, it's a really good story. But the link with basketball is that she's got this little friend called Volodya. Volodya.
Okay.
And this little Volodya, the little friend, the little boyfriend she's got, is really into basketball. And so the first money she gets from selling her body, she buys him a basketball, and he's over the moon. And he's got a really, really miserable life. His dad's thrown him out of the house. He's kind of living on the streets, but he's buddied up with Lilia. And so the basketball is representing to the lad who really likes basketball happiness. And then his dad throws him out and destroys the ball, ending his relationship with his family and his happiness, etc. So there are lots of kind of meaningful things going on. It's a bit of an art house film, and it was really, really good. It's worth watching. But in the last sequence of the film, the pair of them are on a rooftop playing basketball very happily, and it's a film about their friendship, really, and the misery that comes about for them, and the difficulties that they face because of it. But yeah, Lilia Forever, it's called, and it. How did I track that down? It was on one of the services. In the end, I found it. So that was my tentative basketball link.
Right. Okay. You know, if I was a teacher in school and you turned in that essay, Mr. Salmon, I'd tell you to go away and do it again.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I was not very well prepared for that, but. There was a tentative link in there to basketball. There's an even less tentative link to my next one, because I thought that I remember a scene in Woody Allen's Annie Hall where he'd gone to a basketball game, but I must have dreamt it unless I'd seen some sort of deleted scene or something at some point. But I looked it up, and so this is going to be a bit of trivia about basketball and movies than anything else. But apparently they did film, as part of Annie Hall, they did film a sequence where Alvy plays on a team with philosophers against the New York Knicks, which I guess is the big team in New York. And there was a kind of whole load of gags built into this scene, and because when they made the film, it was like a double the length of that it had to be, you know, to finish it, they just cut scenes out, and it's a real great shame, because I'm sure I've seen it, but I just can't track it down and I can't find it, but.
It might be on the DVD as a deleted scene or something.
Yeah, maybe. I just couldn't find it anywhere. Anyway, so that's a bit of trivia, is that there is somewhere in Annie Hall a basketball scene which apparently is really funny, and it's not there in the final cut, the normal final cut. So there you go. Two really tentative links to basketball.
Okay, all right. Well, I suppose it could have been worse. You could have just, you know, had, you know, a basket case carrying a ball or something like that. I don't know.
I could have just not found anything and sat here and said, I have never seen one, but I've made the effort. So there you go. Right.
It's always interesting that you've picked baseball for the next one. Right, okay.
The next one I'm going to pick for us to do is very, very simple. And it's food.
Oh, no, I hate food. I try to have as little food as possible.
The world is full of films and TV shows about food, so we should have some quite good fun with that, I think. So that's what's coming on the next show. Our themed treat is food.
And you're going to talk about Hannibal again, aren't you?
Everyone likes food. Go away, you. Right, let's go to the main feature. You can go first.
All right, well, I'll quickly mention that I did catch up with you and watch that movie, The Drift, also known as Ice Skater. It was all right. It was a fairly... it was hard to get on with that, I do have to admit.
Yeah.
The first 20 to 30 minutes were relatively entertaining, but then soon after that, it slowed down to a trudge and became a little less believable every minute that it ticked on.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't believe they actually used the trope of being able to get cell coverage out in the middle of the Arctic Ocean.
if that was real and not hallucinated.
Well, I don't think they alluded too much to it being a hallucination, and given the outcome of the film, it makes me think that it was real in some way.
Some commentators say that the outcome of the film is likely hallucination too.
Right. Okay. Well, you could say that about anything. You know, she just hallucinated. Maybe she's just lying at the bottom of a cliff. Suffering from concussion, hallucinating left, right, centre. Right. Okay.
I reckon she's dead in the cold water, because she would not have survived. I'll put a link in the show notes to my review again on that, because I speculate about the whole thing there as well. Sorry, back to you.
No. It was all right. I would never go near it again. It's a really interesting premise.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they took the easy way out as it went along. And as you mentioned, it's exceptionally low budget, and the special effects are not quite up to snuff to be able to carry on the make-believe that we're experiencing. So she was very good. The girl in the lead, was it Thea Sophie Loch Ness? Yeah, she was excellent, and it's a really demanding role for one person to support the entire film and be constantly interesting and engaging, and she does really hard work, really hard good work to keep the audience going, and they don't hate her by the end of it. She doesn't get mauled by a polar bear, which is...
No.
I suppose that's a bit of a spoiler, isn't it? But... it would have been a bit of a poor ending had something like that happened, because I wasn't a bit invested in it with her, because I did care a bit about her. But give it a go if you've got absolutely nothing better to watch. But I wouldn't say go and pay too much money to watch this, because it's not really worth every penny that you're going to pay. But over on Netflix on January the 16th, The Rip arrived, and I've been excited about this for a while. I like the director Joe Carnahan, who directed Narc, and I think he did Dark Blue as well, didn't he? I can't remember. But he is a really good cop movie director and writer. I think he was a cop or something like that. I can't remember. It's been a while. But he has two films coming out. One was a really low budget TV movie about some guys who were stuck on an upturned boat. I remember we talked about the trailer and thought it didn't look great, but it's hard to believe that came out at the same time as this, which is a big slick thriller starring Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, Steven Yeun. Who else is in it? There's a good cast there. Scott Adkins, Kyle Chandler, Catalina Sandarino, Marino, and it's just a very tense film about a couple of Miami cops who come across one of them gets a tip about a stash house, which is where they either keep drugs or keep money, and they go to this house to secure the money and you know, make a bust, really. And whenever they get there, there's a ridiculous amount of money, and they start to panic because they start to become wary of themselves, of each other, who to trust. you know, because there's a stupid amount of money and there's phone calls coming in saying, you've got half an hour to get out of there. Turn your back, take whatever you want and just go. And you know, it is a question of who do they trust? You know, Damon and Affleck are the two lead cops and they don't quite trust each other and they're constantly fighting about it. And you know, every background character is questionable. Is this person communicating with the drug dealers or what? And then whenever there's other gangsters and drug lords that show up and they're not connected and there's red herrings and all sorts of things throughout. It's a very tidy little thriller. It's not exceptional. It's not worth raving about like Narc or something from all those years ago. But it is good enough. And it's a claustrophobic thriller as well because it is essentially set in one house at the end of a cul-de-sac, save for a rather large action climax that takes place outside of that. But the majority of the film takes place in this one house where they're kind of, you know, bunkering in, hunkering down and reinforcing the place so that they can sit out, do the count because they have to count the money before the police that they've called arrive, so that everything's accounted for, and that, it all makes it very tense. And you are questioning, you know, which character is good, which character is bad, even down to the two leads, and you're wondering, you know, is this it? You know, what Matt Damon's character is talking about how if he he's got a few money problems, or if he had a certain amount of money, he'd be able to take himself off. And Ben Affleck's got something going on as well. So they have reasons and motives to possibly, you know, steal this. And maybe they're also bent, I suppose, that they're bent cops. And it delivers. It's a really nice thriller, a solid, edgy thriller. That's not going to bring the house down on you, but you'll be entertained throughout. It's long enough that it's not once and done. Yeah, there's enough to bite into and for you to enjoy 2 hours of thrilling entertainment. It's good stuff. Good stuff. Ted, have you watched this or seen it? Or
no, but you watched the trailer, you just talked me into it. I think that sounds really, really good. And the trailer was rolling while you were talking, and yeah, it looks great. Did we do this in Coming Soon? I think we did, didn't we?
We did, yeah.
Yeah, the trailer looked familiar, and I have not kind of tracked it down and watched it, and I certainly will now because you, as I say, you've talked me into it. That's really, it sounds really good.
And Ben Affleck and Scott Adkins playing brothers. How has that not happened before? That's amazing. They're perfect. They are brothers. More convincing than Casey Affleck and Ben Affleck, I have to say.
Right.
But yeah. Cool. Good film.
Yeah. I shall definitely watch it. Well done. Thank you for the tip. Right, a couple of quick ones for me before we get to Coming Soon, which is Hamnet, I spoke about earlier. Which is the film for which Jessie Buckley won Best Supporting Actress. And I went into this knowing absolutely nothing about Shakespeare. I've never studied Shakespeare, never read it.
Have you heard of him?
I've heard of him, yeah. I'd never studied it or watched a film about it or been to a play or anything. I knew nothing about Shakespeare. And so I thought I was going to be really bored and it was going to be rubbish. And to be honest, the only reason I was watching it was because Jessie Buckley was in it. But actually, I was wrong, and it was really good. It was good. There was lots of good atmosphere going on. The story is about, it's kind of half true, based on some truth about Shakespeare and his wife, who had 3 children, and one of them died. And so he went off to write a Hamlet, which apparently is the same as Hamlet. No, Hamnet. The two words are interchangeable in 1590s England. And he went off to write a play in honor of the dead son. But the turn in the film is the fact that we're living with the family while Shakespeare starts to realize that he needs to be away from home to go and write and be in London and Buckley's character doesn't want to go away to London. She likes it in the country. She's got this connection with nature going on, and there is some suggestion about kind of she's a bit of a witch or whatever, but she's not really. And she is very happy being at home in the countryside, rural setting, looking after her little family. And Shakespeare wants to be off, you know, becoming famous and all the rest of it. And a lot of the film is about that. It's a kind of hopeful film. It's about invisible people in history, the wives and children of people left behind when men go off to try and change the world, sort of thing. And so, yeah, the story is very much about that. But it's just been shot really, really beautifully. And the costumes are great. And it's really convincing. And the acting is just phenomenal from everyone. And, you know, you can see why it should really be winning awards. It's a great film. But if you think that, oh, bugger, it's Shakespeare, it's going to be really boring, then honestly, it isn't. It's really, really well done, and you don't need to know anything about Shakespeare to be able to enjoy it.
Mm.
So that was my first one, and my other one was Bone Lake, which I watched last night. And this is a little thriller by Mercedes Bryce Morgan, and it's about this couple who turn up at this house, and they have rented it for the weekend. It's a really big house, interesting big house by this lake called Bone Lake, which, as we find out later, is full of bones from a serial killer who was previously killing people and dumping their bones in the river, in the lake. Anyway, that is a bit of a side issue, because when they turn up at this house, almost as soon as they get there, this other couple turn up. And this other couple are claiming that they've also booked the place for the weekend. So the nearest hotel is 50 miles away. No one wants to go there. So they negotiate between them, and they decide that this house is huge and they'll just make the most of it. And even though they're strangers, they appear to be getting on quite well. And then we spend time with them in the house. They discover these padlock doors in the house as well, which comes back later to be a feature in the film. One of them is a really good cook, and they have loads of booze, and they start to get to know each other. The women spend time together, the men do, and they're all just having quite a good time as a newly introduced foursome. That's about all I can tell you, because anything else would just be a complete plot kind of spoiler, because things just at that point start to become a bit odd and a bit not quite as they seem, and the people might not be quite as they seem. And the house, it turns out, has got some secrets. Yes, you guessed it, behind padlocked doors. And it's a really good hour and a half kind of, you know, thriller, which works really well. The girl in the lead has Hassan, is that her name? Maddie Hassan. She was in Mr. Mercedes, which my dad is watching at the moment, funnily enough.
Oh, yeah.
And she plays the lead, you know, the main lead, really, in the film, really well. She's very convincing. The rest of them are quite good as well, but she obviously is the star of the show. And the cinematography is good. The characters are interesting. The unfolding story, you know, there's tension building as we get towards the end, and it turns out to be actually a very good thriller. But I really won't tell you any more about it, because you should watch it, because it is... any more would just spoil it for you. So go and watch it. It's called Bone Lake, and it's on a couple of streaming services, I think on Sky and Apple at the moment, but it's coming along. And I recommend it.
Cool. Yeah, I've seen that advertised, actually. It does look rather good. I heard it was a bit racy.
Oh, the erotic thriller bit of it is, there's a couple of scenes in it, but it's not really that, it's certainly not graphic. It's more like people walking towards a bathroom and you see them, the back of them, full nudity from the back. That kind of Ooh. Level, you know. And when they're shagging in the beds, you just don't, nothing much of it is on display. But yeah, it's a bit steamy here and there.
Fair enough. Okay. Well, that's sold it to a few of our listeners, I'm sure.
Right. Okay. So there you go. That's our main feature. Links in the show notes, as always, and to my reviews. And it's time for Coming Soon, Gareth.
Aye, that it is. And we're going to start where we should always start, with a killer creature feature. And that would be, oh no, it's not actually, that's later on. We're going to start with something that's not a killer creature feature. I got mine mixed up because Bait is the name of a killer crocodile movie from years ago.
Oh, yeah.
A shark movie.
So it is.
But it's not. It's an upcoming TV series for Amazon Prime that has a bit of a James Bond hook in it, about a young actor on the cusp of landing the role of a lifetime when he finds himself thrust into a fully blown existential crisis and conspiracy at the same time. It's no shock that he has been rumoured to be cast as the new James Bond, and the world reacts. It stars Riz Ahmed, Guz Khan, and a load of playful other characters like Rafe Spall and things like that that you would recognise from various different things over the years. And to be honest, this looks quite funny. It's arriving on March 25th, which I believe is next week. I remember Guz Khan being interviewed about this, and he said it was actually shot about 3 or 4 years ago, and they just it sat there waiting for the right time to be released. And I'm wondering if now is the right time, because there's going to be, maybe toward the end of this, Amazon's going to announce who the next James Bond is, and even Riz Ahmed has been rumored to be the next James Bond, primarily because of this TV series. But I think from the trailer, it actually looks kind of funny, a wee bit dramatic, and I think this could go the length. Ted, what did you think?
I didn't know anything about the James Bond thing. Now you said that, I do remember seeing a bloke in a white suit and a bow tie, which perhaps I should have twigged. And perhaps I wasn't paying enough attention, but I think by then I got fed up with the trailer because it just looked unfunny, and it just looked like a yawn fest, frankly, about actors and filming actors, and I was just switched off. But as I say, I have to admit that I didn't know about the Bond thing, so I'll have another look at it.
Fair enough. Okay. Well, I think they mentioned it. Next up, this looks quite funny, to be honest. This is a new horror film called Obsession. After breaking the mysterious One Wish Willow, which is a chocolate bar or something, to win his crush's heart, a hopeless romantic finds himself getting exactly what he asked for, but soon discovers that some desires come at the dark, sinister price. This is about a guy who fancies a girl and he's securely in the friend zone, and he has the opportunity to make a wish, and he wishes for her to be in love with him, and things go a bit nuts. It turns into a psychological horror, and appears to be a bit of a slasher film as well, as things get bloody and violent toward the end. It seems to have a very nice sense of humour about it, and I'm thinking that Ted's probably going to hate it.
I, I couldn't work out what this one wish willow thing is. Again, I suppose if we were American, we'd probably know this. But it looks like he broke it open and he got a wish. And then,
but we
didn't see what the wish was. And then suddenly it looks like the girl he's after turns into a vampire or a serial killer or something.
He wishes that she falls in love with him. And then she does, but psychotically in love with him.
Oh, so she's, like, then stalking him or whatever. Oh,
did
okay.
Did you have the volume on when you watched this?
Well, I thought I had. I just couldn't quite work out what was going on. I thought it was just... I thought the trailer was just really confusing. Anyway, the second half of the trailer obviously pepped up. The first half of the trailer, I thought, oh, this looks really boring. But then when she started to go Fruit Loop and there was blood everywhere, I thought, oh, yeah, well, this looks all right. but by that point, I convinced myself she was a vampire.
All right, okay. She's just a deranged psycho. And I'm sure that if you watch the trailer, folks, you'll know someone. You've gone out with a girl who's a bit like this, I'm sure, at some stage in your life.
Okay, okay. So that's the second one that I've got to watch again.
All right. Capture is another fairly strong-looking horror film. Sorry, we're going a bit horror at the moment, but
that's
what we were dealt out during the week that was interesting. This is about it's a found footage horror film. After the mysteriously inheriting her parents' house, after mysteriously inheriting her parents' house, a lifelong orphan finds a camcorder and a collection of videotapes containing the gruesome secrets of her family's past and the horrifying truth between the camcorder or on the, behind the camcorder they had there they were captured on. So it looks like an effectively little scary little film about a girl who inherits a house, drives to this small town, is advised by the locals to keep away, but she doesn't. She goes in and finds out the truth, and things turn nasty. Ted, you've noted this is a found footage movie.
Well, it looks like it to me.
She finds footage. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it just looked really complicated, and I thought, why can't we have simple films anymore? When I looked at what this the kind of backdrop to this is, that I got this quote, which is, "Anyone the camera records doesn't just relive the past; they die." What begins as a disturbing discovery soon becomes a desperate fight for survival as the camcorder's supernatural power refuses to stay buried. And I, at the end of all this, I thought, this is complicated, and it just felt like it was a load of rubbish. But that's the third one I've got to watch again, I think.
All right, okay. I felt this looked decent enough, and it's not a cheap horror film. It looks to have a bit of money behind it as well, and a good bit of polish on it. So I've got high hopes for that. That's arriving on March 15th, which has happened already, so it might be out on whatever service it is due to go out on. Right. I believe it's the cinema.
Right.
Okay. It's not Shudder. Right.
Right.
The next one is Fuse. That's arriving on April 3rd. This is a potentially quite interesting-looking London-based thriller. I think this is a British movie, about an unexploded World War II bomb that has been discovered on a busy construction site in the centre of London. Chaos ensues as the military and the police begin a mass evacuation against a ticking clock. I'll be honest with you. I put this in about 2 weeks ago in the show notes, and I've kind of forgotten what it was. it's fully about. But there's a sniper, and there seems to be a plot. Where, thankfully, it's got a plot somewhere in it, and it stars Aaron Taylor Johnson, Theo James, and Sam Worthington, and it's all shot on a particular street that I went. And looking to see if it was a real street. Was it like, I can't remember. Ted, you'll know the street. What was the street called?
I don't know. How would I know?
Because they say in the trailer about six times.
Oh, do they? Again, I probably switched off by then. I was trying to keep up with it because it started off looking like a straightforward kind of, you know, unexploded bomb story, which looked really interesting. And I thought, yeah, this has got it's an interesting topic to make a film about. But then it started to get kind of more complex and other stuff came along. And then there was a bank heist going on. And then there was this and that. And it ended up looking like some kind of macho man, high octane thriller by the end of it. So I'm not saying that it won't be good. It might well be good, but I just got confused. And, you know, I need to perhaps watch the trailer again.
It's bothering me because I was trying to make a pun on the title because there's a bomb and there's a scene that looks like something from the Hurt Locker. I was thinking like Harrogate Hurt Locker or something like that or what have you. But then I went looking to see if the street was in what the town area was called, but it was in Bracknell, I think it was. Maybe. I can't remember. Right. But it's got Aaron Taylor-Johnson, who, to keep with the James Bond thing, is one of the guys who is tipped to potentially be Bond. There's quite high odds. I don't think it's going to be him, but I think there's high odds that he's in the mix somewhere along the lines.
Okay.
All right. The last one is where I was going with the creature feature, and you can kind of understand why I thought it was called Bait, because this looks like Bait. This is called Thrash. Well, I suppose it looks more like Creep. I'm
crawl.
Getting Creep 2. Crawl. God, I'm not doing well. We're getting Crawl 2 at some point. But this is following a Category 5 hurricane that decimates a coastal town. The storm surge brings devastation, chaos, and something far more frightening. Hungry sharks. And I know what you're thinking, folks. We never talk about sharks on this podcast, and this will be a first, but it's not. We do talk about sharks quite frequently because shark movies are awesome, and especially whenever they have a decent budget like this and the ooze style. It does look like crawl. And it uses the whole plot device and takes away the crocodile and puts in a shark instead. But I'm all right with that because Crawl was damn good fun. And I've got a lot of hopes that this is going to be damn good fun as well because it's got a good cast, good effects. And from the trailer, it seems to have a good style about it as well, where they've thought about how to sort of illustrate a shark in the area without painting the picture too obvious. Ted, what do you think of Thrash?
Yeah, it looks great. I can't wait. It looks like really, really good fun. And as always with these kind of disaster monster films, it could go either way. But you're right. I think the signs in the trailer are that it looks like it's quite well made. The only thing that I wanted to flag up was I'm hoping that they don't take too much time up on this kind of soap opera bit about the pregnant woman in the mix, because the trailer seems to spend a bit longer than perhaps it should on that. But anyway, laying that aside, I think that the film looks like great fun and I am with it.
No, I think the pregnant woman thing could add a little more tension to it. Think about The Quiet Place where she was giving birth. That was kind of, that was tense. Mm. Unbelievable, but tense. Mm.
Okay, then. There you go, then. That's what's coming soon. And links in the show notes to those films and TV shows. And now we're going to go to the final curtain. Is there anyone in here? Oh, yes, there is, isn't there? Yeah,
we have three this week. And we're going to start back where we started. We're going to start, with the Friday the 13th. Part 4, A New Beginning. Pete has passed away, and that would be Corey Parker. He was also known from Biloxi Blues and the school-based comedy How I Got Into College. And I dug up a little bit of trivia about him, actually, whenever I was looking to see if I recognized a few things that he was in. Patrick Dempsey from Grey's Anatomy married his mother, Rocky Parker, and that made him his stepfather. Or Corey was briefly Patrick Dempsey's stepfather, despite the fact he was 1 year younger than him, which I thought was kind of kind of a fun little bit of trivia. But yes, he popped in The Rainmaker, A Mother's Prayer, Flesh Suitcase, which is an interesting sounding film, Eddie Doob, which is a TV series that he was in, and he was in 30-something, actually. I hadn't realized that. That was a classic TV series back in the late 80s, early 90s. He was the janitor in 9 and a Half Weeks. The poor fella had to clean up after those two. right. Okay. So do you recognize Corey Parker at all? No. But you will do whenever you get to Friday the 13th Part 4.
Well, yeah. I'm sure I will by then. But the only one of those films I can remember seeing is 9 and a Half Weeks. And I saw that a few hundred times.
Dirty Beast.
I can assure you. I've got the tissues to prove it. But, you know, it's so long since I've seen it now. I'd have to watch it again to remember who the janitor was. I can only remember the two leads in it, and I'm not familiar with this chappy, sorry.
I dare say he'd be quite a young janitor at that. This, 9 and a Half Weeks, I haven't seen it myself, I'm not a dirt bird like yourself, but that was 1986, and he was born in 1965, so it would have been 21-year-old janitor.
Right.
I'm impressed by my math skills. But yes, it's very sad to hear of his loss. We have a TV series that is due to arrive called The Trouble with Billy. And that looks to have a really good cast. It's got Tom Sizemore, Alison Eastwood, Angus McFadden, Robert Wagner, and a whole rake of other recognisable faces. William Baldwin's in there as well. Right, okay, so I don't know if that will carry on, but it looks from the shots that are on IMDb, I dare say that they have filmed some of it so far. So yeah, it's very sad to hear that.
Yeah.
Next up is an actress who I know quite well from a particular movie, and I've used her name quite a lot, Jennifer Runyon. You'll know her from Ghostbusters. She plays the female student in Dr. Venkman's weird game where he's trying to get people to use their psychic abilities to guess what's on the back of a playing card. And there's a hot girl and a crazy-looking guy, and Venkman keeps zapping the crazy-looking guy because he gets it wrong, and the hot girl gets the cards right every time, even though she got them wrong. And even when the crazy guy gets it right, he still gets zapped. But that was her big movie that she was in. But she had a very healthy career as a character actor in video movies and TV shows. And she was in Up the Creek in 1984, which is a film I reviewed on my site a few years ago. And I really do enjoy that movie. It's basically Animal House on a white water rafting adventure with Tim Matheson. And she plays a character called Heather Merriweather. It's a very nice little upbeat name. It's fun to say. She was also Cindy Brady in the TV movie of A Very Brady Christmas. And she was in the movie The In Crowd, which was back in 1988. But there was a horror film that she was in. I was trying to find it there. It was her first film, actually, To All a Good Night. That's worth checking out if you get a chance as well. She's got a fairly decent role for the first film role for her before she went to Another World, which is a long-running American soap opera, which she was in 111 episodes apparently for 2 years. So yeah, have you ever heard of Jennifer Runyon?
I have not, but I can tell you that the photograph we've got in front of us here shows me that she's very pretty. Ghostbusters, I watched a bit like Friday the 13th, really, is like when it first came out. Back whenever that was, like 45 years ago, I watched it at the cinema. And I've never watched it again. So I just don't stand a chance of remembering what it's about or who's in it or anything, really. I need to do what you do and watch all your films in rotation whenever you've got any downtime so that you can remember who's in them.
Okay, all right. Well, I thought you were watching through the Silent Night, Deadly Night. No, it was Silent Night, Bloody Night she was in, not Deadly Night. Sorry, carry on. Okay. Carnosaur, which was a knockoff of Jurassic Park. Very, very cheap one with Diane Ladd.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I'm afraid I don't know her. I didn't know her, but she was very pretty, wasn't she?
Yes, well, it was indeed, and perfectly cast in Up the Creek. Mm-hmm. So the last one we have to talk about is Matt Clark, who just passed away the other day at the age of 89, and he's a very well-known face, and primarily from Westerns. Having a look at his career, he did an awful lot of Westerns, to be honest. He was in The Outlaw Josie Wales. He was in, it's not quite a Western, but I suppose it's a survival thriller, Jeremiah Johnson with Robert Redford. He was also the bartender in Back to the Future Part 3. But yeah, looking down his career, there was a lot of Westerns, and I know his face from other Westerns as well. It's his upper lip sits up a bit, so he's got a sort of a very expression-y mouth, and if you see his face, you'll go, oh, yes, I know him from, and I'm looking through the Lonesome Dove TV series, not the one with Robert Duvall, but I remember Lonesome Dove whenever I was younger, watching that with my parents. Do you know Matt Clark?
No, I'm sorry. Yet again, I fail you. I did look through the list, though, and saw that he'd been in all sorts of TV shows as well. Like, for example, The Waltons, which I knew really, really well when I was a kid. And Little House on the Prairie, which I mentioned earlier. I used to watch that as well. I have seen The Outlaw, Josie Wales, but the same thing was true about Ghostbusters, really, is that I can't remember anything about The Outlaw, Josie Wales, except that I watched it back in the day, and I thought it was really good. But remembering a face, yeah, this is what the difference is, you see, is that you remember faces from films, like you said just now. I remember he was a bartender, and I wouldn't stand a chance remembering that. But you just seem to be able to remember people's faces in roles really easily.
Well, yes, it helps that he's credited as bartender on Back to the Future. There's no mystical wisdom there. Yeah. But yeah, he was in Pat Garrity and Billy the Kid. That's where I know him from, right, predominantly. But he was also in White Lightning, which was Burt Reynolds' movie, the predecessor to Gator. And The Laughing Policeman. Oh, wow. Oh, man, I have to find that again. That was a corker. So Walter Matthau, 70s detective movie, where he was really playing against type. Oh, man. Obviously not in years. Right? I'm going to find that.
Quick and the Dead. You and Alan spoke about The Quick and the Dead quite recently.
Not that one. There's two Westerns called The Quick and the Dead. There's one with Sam Elliott as well. And that's the one he was in. I haven't actually seen that, but I've been meaning to. He was in Ravenhawk as well, which I remember hiring primarily because of the, I don't know her name, but the lady on the front cover was just exceptional looking. And I thought, right, I'll watch that, and took it home. And it was kind of a middling Native American action movie. But I don't remember him in it, to be honest.
No. Anyway, yeah, very sad. Three people have gone in the last fortnight, including him. So hopefully on the next show we won't have anything in this section at all. The next show, which will be in a fortnight's time, as always, projectorroom.co.uk is our website. GarethMiles.com is where you'll find Gareth's stuff, and TedSalmon.com is where you'll find my stuff, as well as links to all of our MeWe groups, growing by the minute, and all of our other audio podcasts. And Podhub UK will get you all that stuff as well. And we do have a Camera Creations podcast coming out this week as well. So it should be out Thursday this week. So watch out for that one. But yeah, we'll hopefully catch you in the MeWe group and look forward to hearing about what you've been watching so we can bring highlights of that to the show next time in the projector room. Thank you.